Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. It's election day here in the United States, and candidates from the two major parties are still holding rallies at this hour. Donald Trump is in Michigan, Hillary Clinton in North Carolina. Some of the first ballots are being cast in New Hampshire, one of the five states Donald Trump visited on the last full day of his campaign.
I am asking for the votes of all Americans, Democrats, Republicans, independent, first-time voters, and there are a lot of those first-time voters, folks, who are so desperately in need of change. Hillary Clinton's only allegiance is to herself, her donors, and her special interests.
Democrat Hillary Clinton held rallies spearheaded by music superstars in North Carolina, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where President Barack Obama addressed the crowd.
I'm asking you to work as hard as you can this one last day to elect, my fellow Americans, this fighter, this stateswoman, this mother, this grandmother, this patriot, our next president of the United States of America, Hillary Clinton!
Polls heading into Election Day give Clinton a 2-3 point lead over Donald Trump. You can find more on the U.S. presidential elections as well as live coverage Tuesday evening at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Hispanics have turned out in record numbers to vote early this election season, leading to speculation that they may affect the outcome of the race in some key states, including perhaps the important state of Texas. Hispanics seem to be responding to rhetoric from Republican Donald Trump on immigration. Trump may have awakened what many call the sleeping giant when he described the Mexican immigrants as rapists and murderers last year. Kurdish-led Syrian forces, backed by U.S. air power and military advisors, captured a number of Islamic State positions amid heavy fighting on Monday north of Raqqa. Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook said the U.S. does not underestimate the hard work ahead, adding that Syrian Democratic Forces have already made progress in the early days of the advance, supported by the U.S.-led coalition airstrikes. The Syrian Democratic Forces announced on Sunday the start of an offensive to gain control of Raqqa, the northern Syrian city overrun by Islamic State extremists in 2014 and self-designated as the center of extremist rule. Iraqi authorities say the military coalition pressing a huge offensive against Islamic State extremists near the city of Mosul have uncovered a mass grave containing at least 100 decapitated bodies. The victims are believed to be civilians. Islamic State fighters have controlled Mosul and its outlying towns and villages for more than 2 years, and civilians who have recently escaped have described repeated incidents of mass executions by the extremists. Israel has repeated its opposition to a French-sponsored international conference to revive peace efforts with the Palestinians. The conference was proposed to start before the end of the year. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken out against the meeting and repeatedly called for direct negotiations with the Palestinians. Mr. Netanyahu's emissaries made clear that Israel will not participate in any international conference convened contrary to that position. China has declared that democratically elected pro-independence lawmakers in Hong Kong should not be allowed to take up their seats in the legislature, weighing in on a dispute over the way their oaths were taken during a swearing-in ceremony last month. Two pro-independence politicians draped themselves in banners that declared Hong Kong is not China and pledged allegiance to the Hong Kong nation. It was not immediately clear how many lawmakers would be affected by the order, but Beijing's conclusion that some are unfit for office because of the way they took their oaths has already triggered an uproar. And South Korean President Park Geun-hye says she would allow lawmakers to select her next prime minister, a major political concession to growing anger as she tries to defuse an escalating influence peddling scandal. Park has faced tens of thousands of protesters and an investigation into whether one of her confidants manipulated government decisions. Tuesday's concession could severely curtail her ability to govern the 15 months she has left in office. I'm Michael Brown in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Americans are voting today, Tuesday, in presidential election.
We will make America strong again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again.
Vice Republican Party presidential candidate Donald Trump. You will also hear from Democratic Party candidate Hillary Clinton. We'll tell you about the controversy over voter ID laws in some states. Young Ugandans pick sides in the U.S. election. The United Nations expresses concerns about food shortage in South Sudan. And relatives of those detained for protesting in Ethiopia say many are still in detention.
So this is something that's been happening a lot, where there's this collective punishment of the whole society, those individuals that do not support the government and are not connected to the ONLF in any way are being targeted.
That's Felix Horn of Human Rights Watch. And as the climate change conference begins this week, some Africa-based researchers hope to see more details emerge about developmental funds. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's Africa's Post Roundup, and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Perhaps the most caustic, exhausting, and at times surreal U.S. presidential campaign in modern political history will end today, Tuesday, as Americans make their choice between Republican Party candidate Donald Trump and Democratic Party candidate Hillary Clinton. As Mariama Diallo reports, the candidates made their final push for votes yesterday and late into the night.
This is a marathon today.
Candidates aren't getting much sleep.
Dark, divisive, dangerous vision.
Donald Trump campaigned in five states on Sunday and another five on Monday.
We will make America strong again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again.
In the battleground state of Florida, Trump continued to accuse rival Hillary Clinton of wrongdoing, saying she's being protected by a rigged system.
Nobody in this room can believe what's going on with the FBI and what's going on with the Department of Justice. Nobody. Nobody can.
On Sunday, FBI Director James Comey told Congress that a new review of emails related to Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State once again revealed no evidence of criminal activity. As for the Democrats, they were all out on the campaign trail Monday, including President Obama, who reminded a crowd in Michigan what his administration has done the past 8 years.
Plants that were closing when I took office are working double shift now. The auto industry, it has record sales. I think I've earned some credibility here. Manufacturing jobs have grown at the fastest rate since the 90s. When another Clinton was president, I think we've earned some credibility here.
For her part, Clinton told a rally in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the choice couldn't be more evident.
It really is between division or unity, between strong and steady leadership or a loose cannon, between an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top.
As the campaigns wound down, Americans are already looking beyond Election Day.
Well, you're talking to a woman whose husband is a Republican. So, I don't know. My husband and I made it through many elections, very fondly, still very much in love. And I think that people down deep are just people. Your neighbor is still your neighbor.
You know, with every election, even with Al Gore, there was a period of healing, but we will come together and we will do what is necessary.
The problems that there are right now are going to take some time and healing, and so it's nothing that can happen in one day's time.
But for now, healing will have to wait until Tuesday when American voters make their choice at the ballot box. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Americans are casting ballots today for president amid a backdrop of new voting laws in more than a dozen states that require voters to produce identification before they are allowed to cast their ballot. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from Greensboro, North Carolina, on the history of these laws and the controversy surrounding them.
Voters in some 30 states are now required to produce a government-issued photo identification before being allowed to cast their ballot. More states have been requiring this since the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001.
There were some who said that this would be a way to be able to prevent people from illegally obtaining the right to vote, perhaps having terrorists have the right to vote. And so all of a sudden there was this discussion now about whether or not identification should be required.
But in states like North Carolina, which had a strict voter ID law since 2013, a court struck down the requirement earlier this year, saying it discriminated against African Americans. Some black voters say the law has racist intentions.
Suppress, fear, intimidation, and not, you know, what you're afraid of. What are you afraid of? Let people exercise the right and vote their choice.
But studies suggest a decade-old voter ID law in Georgia has had little impact on suppressing the vote.
One of the ironies of the voter identification law here in Georgia is that it has not had an adverse impact on African-American voter turnout. So, in fact, African-American voter turnout has actually increased in Georgia since the passage of the voter ID laws.
Proponents of the strict voter ID requirements say they are designed to eliminate widespread voter fraud. But critics contend there's no evidence of widespread fraud. Independent voter Scott Herrick says it would be foolish to commit voter fraud because the penalties are severe.
And what's the payoff for it if I go and try to pretend I'm somebody else, you know, and cast one ballot and risk, what, years of jail?
North Carolina political science professor Charles Prisby says voter fraud is not a problem.
There's different kinds of voter fraud. The one that almost never occurs is people coming down in person and trying to impersonate somebody else.
Political analysts say they'll be watching to see if voter ID laws have a negative impact on turnout among minority groups in this election, such as Asian Americans and Latino voters. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
The 2016 U.S. presidential election is sparking some keen interest among young Ugandan politicals. Fierce discussion on social media, packed debate venues, and election night parties have highlighted a culture of young Ugandans who feel intricately connected to the U.S. election. Lisbeth Pollard reports from Kampala.
Grace Abajo plans to spend the U.S. election night writing furiously until the polls close. A prominent blogger and founder of the Team Hillary Uganda Coalition, he says American politics warrants global participation.
So as a Ugandan and as a person who has so much interest in Hillary, as trying to sell my idea to the world, to Americans especially, most of the funding here, we get it from the United States. Makes so many Ugandans like me interested in what happens in America.
Abajo says the Clinton versus Trump debate in Uganda has ended friendships within his social circle and revealed a growing divide between liberal and conservative views in Uganda. Ugandan public opinion was in part swayed by an unverified online report quoting Trump as saying he'd lock up longtime African dictators such as Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. The report, variations of which were carried on several news sites in the region for months, does not appear to have been true. However, Ugandan Trump supporter Benin Robi says it spread like wildfire among the country's opposition supporters.
I know when he comes to power, mm-hmm. he will help us here, like with the political situation in the country. Mm-hmm. He would literally help us.
Recently, two Ugandan Trump supporters were arrested outside the U.S. Embassy in Kampala, protesting African dictatorships. Robe says these ideas have led to intense discussions among his social circle.
The whole of last evening, I was with friends discussing American politics. Basically, we're counting down. Part of us were on the other side, and a couple of us were on Trump's side. So basically the whole night, it was the whole night up to 2 a.m., we're discussing American politics and counting down.
Martha Nakafero says Ugandan interest in American politics is just part of being informed.
Let me use that quote, that when America sneezes, the whole world gets a cold. Like, it affects us. In America, we don't actually vote, but we are affected. In fact, I think that the outcome of the elections in America affect us more than the outcomes of Kenya's election, who are just our neighbors.
Yet supporters on both sides agree that just months after Uganda's own contentious presidential race, the U.S. election has helped recapture the energy of youth voters in Uganda. Armed with smartphones and minute-by-minute updates, they can post opinions without self-censorship, engaging in a global political community where they feel their voice can be heard. Elizabeth Pala for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 8th, and Election Day here in the United States. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Human Rights Watch says the Ethiopian government arrested and detained dozens of relatives of Ethiopians who participated in a protest in Australia in June. One protester says his elderly mother was arrested and detained for a month as a result of his involvement, and his three brothers are still missing. VOA's Jill Craig has the story from Nairobi.
25-year-old Shukri Shafe Guled comes from the Somali regional state in Ethiopia, but has been living in Australia since 2010. In June 2016, he and other protesters gathered in Melbourne to demonstrate against the visit of an Ethiopian delegation that included a state president, Abdi Mahmoud Omar, known as Abdi Ely, who was accused of human rights abuses back home. Guled says pro-government supporters took his photograph and told him that within 15 minutes they would punish his relatives living in Ethiopia. He says his three brothers were detained that day and have not been heard from since. Guled says his sister and his elderly mother were detained for about a month.
And she doesn't even know what's going on with the protest. And this protest had been happening in like tens of thousands of kilometers beyond the ocean.
Human Rights Watch Horn of Africa senior researcher Felix Horn says the Ethiopian government arrested and detained dozens of relatives of the people who protested that day in Australia and is still holding many of them 4 months later. It's a practice that's been occurring in the Somali regional state for a number of years, he says.
So this is something that's been happening a lot, where there's this collective punishment of the whole society, those individuals that do not support the government and are not connected to the ONLF in any way are being targeted. And we're now seeing that happening in Australia and other places as well. So it's a major problem.
Pro-government supporters told protesters in Melbourne that they should make a video pledging support for Abdi and the government in order to secure the release of their relatives. Guled has refused, saying he prefers to use his voice to help others.
I believe that if I get the courage to come out and speak about it, then many people will follow me. And in that way, I can save so many people.
The Ethiopia government spokesman was not immediately available for comment. Horn says HRW previously documented human rights abuses by the Ethiopian army when Abdi was the head of security in the Somali regional state, and says Australia needs to improve its vetting procedures. The Australian government responded that Abdi's visa application did not raise an alert. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
More South Sudanese will continue to suffer from food shortages in the coming months, despite a fairly good harvest in the past season. This, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. The FAO says the economic downturn, coupled with insecurity in the Greater Equatorial region, which produces more than half of the country's net cereal production, is increasing food insecurity. Wakil Simon Wudu has more from the capital, Juba.
Juba resident Kenyi Yasin says due to the economic crisis, he finds it much more difficult to put food on the table compared to 4 months ago, as prices have skyrocketed.
All the goods in the market have already rise up, and even the transport has also gone up. For example, from Juba to Kajikeji, by then it was £300, now it is £1,000. And also the price of fuel, it has gone up, by then it was £6. It has increased to 22 SSP pounds. The small water, by then it was only £6, but now it is £10. In other places you can get with 12 pounds, there's no fixed rates. In a hotel it is £20, then including this cup of tea. By then a cup of tea is with £5. Now it is in £15.
Margaret Victor, another Juba resident, says she can no longer afford to buy basic food items. For example, she says a kilogram of sugar, which used to cost 15 or 20 South Sudanese pounds some months ago, now cost 100 South Sudanese pounds.
Before, people can afford meal for 2 to 3, but nowadays you cannot afford 1 meal in a day. It's really, really difficult. Say the prices are adding to the twice. For example, when you want to buy a meat for 50, now you can buy it for 200 or 300. Before, we used to buy it for 1 pound at least. Now these days, there is no salt for 1 pound. It's 5 pounds.
The UN Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO, estimates that the number of severely food insecure people is 3.7 million in South Sudan. That is more than a third of the country's estimated population. FAO says this is an increase of an overall 1 million people compared to the same period last year. Abdul Osman, the FAO senior program officer in South Sudan, says the increase is due to failure of farmers to cultivate during the planting season.
The increase in this number at this time is very critical because it indicates that in 2017, the food insecurity situation is going to deteriorate in a very high rapidly, and the risk of famine would increase in most parts of South Sudan.
Although recent harvests have slightly improved, FAO experts warn that the benefits will be short-lived as local stocks will deplete rapidly. FAO warns that following seasonal patterns, food insecurity levels in 2017 is likely to worsen, adding that the risk of famine has increased, especially for South Sudan's most vulnerable communities. Osman says the Equatorial region, which is responsible for over half of the country's net cereal production annually, has been severely impacted by the recent violence. Osman says the displacement of people from those areas is also likely to negatively affect food production.
In some areas, like Bahr al-Ghazal, there is a severe reduction due to a combination of factors. These factors include the economic crisis, the market failure, and at the same time, the loss of the depletion of livelihood assets in those areas.
Both FAO officials and Juba residents are calling on South Sudan's leaders to restore stability to enable farmers to return to their fields. For VOA, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
As the COP22 Climate Change Conference begins this week, some Africa-based researchers hope to see more details emerge about development funds. At the 2009 meeting, members agreed that developed countries would set a goal of raising $100 billion a year through the year 2020 to help developing countries mitigate and adapt to climate change. According to the Green Climate Fund, so far about $10 billion has been raised. Richard Monack, Africa Climate Change Coordinator at the United Nations Environmental Program, tells Ricky Stryak that how these funds are spent should be a key issue at the conference.
One of the key priorities that will be discussed, which is a priority for the African continent, will be to answer the question whether climate finance will be new money or just repackaged development assistance. At COP22, most least developing countries, especially countries from Africa, see a cause to worry that countries will respond to pressure to put up the 100 billion in climate finance by drawing from the development assistance account. And in other words, without transparency and monitoring, developed countries could take money they had planned to give to developing countries anyway, label it as climate finance and say they have fulfilled the obligation. So finance will be quite a very sticky issue. And what is going to be discussed here by most African countries, you will hear a lot about accountability, transparency, and monitoring climate finance over the next 2 weeks. Another aspect which is of very huge priority for the continent is what counts as adaptation.
This $100 billion is supposed to be used to help with climate change adaptation. Can you tell me what that is and then what kind of programs can be funded through this?
The concept of adaptation comes into build resilience because the changing climate is already affecting so many communities. The African continent is already faced with El Niños, whether it is the drought that is affecting Southern Africa or those that affected Eastern Africa in 2011 and the Sahel in 2012. So the kind of impact, changing climate impacts, warrant investment in disaster risk reduction in areas of public health in areas of food security, which kind of crops could be planted, drought-resistant crop, which kind of irrigation techniques, application of drip irrigation, utilizing renewable energy, and at the same time also ensuring that early warning systems could be put in place to not only predict when there could be a flood, but at the same time also ensure that alternatives can be provided to people to move away from climate disaster-prone areas in terms of farming.
Can you give me some concrete examples of maybe adaptation activities that UNEP is involved in sub-Saharan Africa?
In Mozambique, they assisted Mozambique not only to help them in a city called Shai Shai to plant mangroves, because the communities in this area were actually cutting down mangroves, and the intervention in this area where there was a vulnerability assessment carried out and showed that there was already changing climate and it was causing crop failure, and the communities were cutting down mangroves for charcoal. So the intervention was to get the communities rehabilitate and reforest the mangroves by training them to grow seedlings for mangroves, and at the same time providing them alternatives like fish farming and crab farming. And so they reforested these mangroves, which have helped not only to act like a harbor for fisheries.
That was Richard Monack, Africa Climate Change Coordinator at the United Nations Environmental Programme. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Nairobi, Kenya. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa's Pulse. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with female football. Nigeria's under-20 female national team, the Falcons, left the country on Monday for Papua New Guinea to participate in the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup. The team is placed in Group B alongside Spain, Canada and Japan, and will play their first match against Japan on November the 13th. Nigeria, alongside four other countries, have made it to all editions of the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup. The Falcons have lost in the finals in 2010 and 2014. Elsewhere, Ghana's female senior national team, the Black Queens, will play Ideal Ladies FC in a friendly game later this afternoon at the Accra Sports Stadium as part of preparations for the 2016 Women's AFCON. This will be a preparatory game ahead of an international friendly with Cote d'Ivoire on Friday. The Queens will also play the Bayana team of South Africa on Sunday at the same venue. To men's football now, where Zambia under-20 coach Bastian Chambeshi says reaching the semis of the total under-20 African Cup of Nations as host will be their initial target heading into the biennial tourney next year. The young Chipolopolos will play host to the rest of the continent from 26 February to 12th of March 2017 in what will be their first staging of a continent football event. Zambia will be in Group A and will battle Guinea, Mali and four-time champions Egypt. Ahead of this weekend's FIFA 2018 World Cup qualifying matches, Algeria have suffered a huge blow after a spate of withdrawals from their squad as the Fennec Foxes prepare to storm Nigeria for match day 2 of the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifying matches. First, it was a withdrawal of Adam Onoas, who was getting his first call-up by Algeria following his international switch from France. The Fennec Foxes have been hit with yet another round of injuries to key players. Dynamo Zagreb's Saudi Al-Hilal is the latest to withdraw from the squad, as well as Montpellier's Riyad Bodoboz, who started the last game against Cameroon. Rachid Gazelle will also miss the game in Uyo as new Algeria coach George Lekins tries to manage the situation. On the Nigerian side, a total of 12 players were at the Super Eagles Abuja camp on Monday night ahead of Saturday's 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier against Algeria. The players already in camp include Arsenal's Alex Iwobi, Manchester City's Kelechi Iheanacho, Ogenyi Onazi, Kenneth Omerua, Leon Balogun, Odion Ighalo, Moses Simon, Ikechukwu Ezinwa, and Kingsley Madu. In other sports news, the Proteas of South Africa have taken a 1-0 lead in the three-match test series against Australia after winning by 177 runs in Perth. Australia hadn't lost the first test of a home season since 1988. The legendary Ethiopian runner Haile Gebrselassie has been elected to a 4-year term as president of the Athletics Federation of his country. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Tuesday, November 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping all of you in Africa will have a very good day.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people choose a new president. VOA's live election night coverage begins at 2200 hours Universal Time. As events unfold, we'll bring you the finale of this historic campaign from Washington and VOA correspondents across the United States and around the world. Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, you'll hear comprehensive coverage until the last speech is done. It's America Votes 2016 on VOA.